Can a workplace be intentionally joyful?
When I ask people to contemplate two serious questions related to joy, I ask them, who do you serve and what would delight look like for them?
That's Rich Sheridan, CEO, co-founder, and chief storyteller at Menlo Innovations. He's also author of Joy Inc. and Chief Joy Officer. After a software career that textbooks would define as wildly successful, Rich knew he wasn't fulfilled. He had to dig deep and remember why he began his career journey in the first place. Ultimately, this led him to a question. Why couldn't a workplace be filled with camaraderie, human energy, creativity, and productivity? Well, he decided it could. In 2001, Rich co-founded Menlo Innovations, a custom software firm that sets out to end human suffering in the workplace as it relates to technology. The culture he shaped is so unique that 3,000 people a year travel from around the world to Menlo's offices in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They come to see how his team works.
The act of building things by itself doesn't produce personal satisfaction. It is when your work is delivered to the world and received in large numbers, and then people who are using it come back and say, thank you. You made my life better because of what you've done.
I'm Merrill McDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. And now, Rich Sheridan. Welcome to Let Go and Lead. I'm here today with Richard Sheridan, the CEO and co-founder and chief storyteller at Menlo Innovations. Rich, so glad to have you here today.
It's a delight to be with you, Merrill.
You know, this is obviously an interesting time. And for our listeners, we're recording this podcast the first week of April. So we're in an unprecedented time. And one of the things that you and I are going to talk about today is joy, which I think is so timely with what everybody's going through. You started Menlo 18 years ago, and from the beginning, joy has been your reason for being. Why is that? Why joy?
You know, a lot of this has to do with my personal history, Merrill. I started out life as a programmer when I was really, really young. First time I touched a computer was 1971. Most of your listeners probably will have trouble believing there were computers in 1971. But I got hooked early. I thought this software thing was amazing. The fact that I could do it, that it seemed like kind of an infinite landscape to be creative on, and ultimately pursued a couple of degrees in computer science and computer engineering, launched a career, and I thought, man, I got the world by the tail. It's something I'm good at. It's something I love to do. It's something the world needs. I'm well prepared for it. The market's about to burgeon. I graduated from Michigan with 2 degrees in 1982, and I thought, this is going to be perfect. And in many ways, for the way the world measures success, it was. But unfortunately for me, my career started turning on my heart. I didn't want to be in the profession anymore because I was seeing so much pain personally, seeing projects, missing deadlines, blowing budgets, delivering crappy quality. All these sort of things were incredibly frustrating to me because I thought it should be better. And I was determined to find a way to make it better. Ultimately, I discovered that the problems I was facing were kind of universal in the industry, which maybe gave me a little bit of comfort. You know, misery loves company. But I thought, I can't do this for another 30 years in my career if it keeps going the way it is. And so I turned to books and authors. I started reading books, not in technology, but on teamwork, on management, on how to organize people better. And along the way, I discovered there is, in fact, a better way of doing things than is customary. I pursued it. I was eventually a VP of R&D for a tired old public company here in Ann Arbor, and I transformed that public company from my VP of R&D post, and probably would still be doing that today had the internet bubble not burst. And in 2001, after I'd lost my job and had to fire everybody who worked for me, I realized that what I had learned in those couple of years just prior could be replicated, could be brought into a new company and take a different approach. And that's how Menlo was born in 2001. And at that point, we talked seriously, my co-founders and I, about what we wanted to bring to the world. And ultimately, we settled on this word, joy. And joy doesn't feel like a business word. I'm sure for most of your listeners, it's probably not the first word that comes to mind when they think of work. But for us, we really wanted to delight the people we intended to serve by taking a different approach, by organizing our team differently, by using different processes and so on. And so the word joy made sense to us because what we wanted to do is delight the people we intended to serve. And that would give us joy if we could do that.
That's such an amazing story. And, you know, one of the things we're really exploring is how leaders can design the organization that they want to become. So I'd be curious just to hear more about how did you actually go about designing an organization for joy?
You know, we made some radical moves in that last 2 years of my time as VP of R&D at Interface Systems. We pulled people out of their offices in cubes, which was not comfortable for them. We put them out in a big open room. We put two of them to one computer all day long, working on the same task at the same time. We switched the pairs every 5 working days so that now knowledge was being disseminated throughout the organization. There was active conversation all day long with your pair partner. We were sitting shoulder to shoulder with one another. So the human energy just lifted up in this organization. And the results, quite frankly, went way past anything I would have imagined at that time.
One of the things I know you've talked about is that you refer to your office as an open factory and talk a lot about your competitive advantage in your environment and collaboration, and that that's a big part of your culture. What's happening now? Are your folks now sheltering at home or are they still in the office?
So here's what we're not doing. And I'll very quickly tell you that we're doing everything our governor and the CDC recommends, but we are not social distancing. We're physically distancing. So we are still pairing, but we're doing it remotely. Yes, everyone's in their homes by themselves with their families. Everyone is separate from one another. And yet each day the pairs come together using audio, video, and screen share, and they are remote pair programming. They are remote working in pairs wherever they happen to be in their homes. And fortunately, with all the tools that are available today, it's possible to do this. Now, we've actually been, unbeknownst to us, we've been practicing for this moment for about 6 years. We have been remote pairing with our clients, programmers who want to adopt a lot of our practices. And so for at least 6 years now, we have been practicing this with our customers, our programmer paired with their programmer, sometimes across the nation, sometimes around the world. And so we've been making this work. It is not ideal. It is not our preferred way of working, but it does work.
Well, that's a great example of adjusting to the times. That's terrific. Given the times that we're in, how do you think joy is factoring into what's going on now?
When I ask people to contemplate two serious questions related to joy about their purpose, I ask them to ask these two questions of themselves and their organizations. Who do you serve? And what would delight look like for them? So externally focused, I think we are wired three ways as human beings. We are wired to work hard. We are wired to work together in community with one another. And we are wired to work on something bigger than ourselves. And I think in that, that is where joy is coming from for the people who are on the front lines of this effort and every one of us who's supporting them.
Your own leadership seems to be really grounded in this mindset. And I'm just curious, you know, one of a leader's job is to manage themselves even more so than managing others. How do you go about that when you think about managing yourself?
You know, I probably asked many times this by my adult children now who are entering their own careers and trying to figure out their version of what I pursued along the way, because they've grown up watching what we've created at Menlo, and they know, I'm in that delightful place as a parent that my kids actually envy what I've created, which is, I can tell you, it's a neat place to be. And I'm glad I'm there. I'm glad I can serve as an example to them. But I often remind them that Menlo was born out of my pain and suffering. Menlo was born out of a time where I thought I had the world by the tail, and the world knocked me down. I was successful. No question. I had everything the world measures as success, whether it was pay, stock options, authority, title, office size, team size, everything. I had it all. And yet my heart was breaking for a career that I thought would carry me for a lifetime. And so I had to dig down deep. I had to sort of rediscover, why did I take this journey in the first place? What was I trying to accomplish? What was it about this profession that actually intrigued me? And I finally realized, and this didn't come immediately, and it didn't come, you know, just by clicking my fingers, I guess. I had to strip away all the things I thought defined success for me and realize that the true success for somebody in my profession, a profession of creating things for others, this idea of engineering work, which is probably always been where my heart lies. I've always been a builder at heart. I like to build things. But the act of building things by itself doesn't produce personal satisfaction. It is when your work is delivered to the world and received in large numbers and, you know, great numbers potentially. And then people who are using it come back, find out you were the one who had a hand in that and said, thank you. You made my life better because of what you've done. And I realized that's what I was being denied when I was going through my trough of disillusionment days. And so I think for me, this ardent pursuit of producing that kind of result in the world drove my optimism. I believed through books I was reading and people I surrounded myself with that I could, in fact, achieve this. It wouldn't be easy, wouldn't be quick. I wasn't looking for fast, easy solutions. I was looking for something meaningful. So I think my optimism comes from, how do I prepare myself? What books do I read? What ideas do I fill myself with? Who do I hang around with and listen to? Who do I admire? Who do I look to for mentorship? And, you know, by sort of carefully sorting how I spend my time and so on, I think that helps me a lot maintain that inner optimist.
What was the process that helped you dig deeper? Because I think a lot of people are feeling that they'd like to better understand themselves and don't know how to go about it.
Yeah, I think I have always been a reader, and I would encourage your listeners to be readers, whether audiobooks or good old-fashioned paper book or ebooks. My personal preference is paper. And because in reading, and I guess I would encourage your listeners to think about books in this way, look to people you admire and ask them what books they're reading. Pick those books up, read the first few pages, maybe the first couple of chapters. If that book grabs you, stay with it. If it doesn't, set it aside, because there's each one of us is going to be driven by different things. There's something in our own makeup that will pull us in a particular direction. But as you're reading those books and you get inspired, start to reflect on yourself. Why? What difference does this make for me? Why did that paragraph or such speak to me? And start to develop this self-awareness. One of my favorite books on this subject, by the way, is a book called The Highest Goal by Stanford professor, business school professor Michael Ray. And he actually asks us to think about the times in our life, typically going back to childhood, where we were sort of in our most blissful state. You know, I can remember when I went through this exercise, I thought about the times I came home from school as a kid and my mom was pulling out that tray full of just baked chocolate chip cookies. And she'd sit down with me and have a glass of milk and we'd just sit and talk. And, you know, those were the times I remembered. And then he asked you to consider, so why was that important to you? And you start getting down to the bare basics of why this is important to you by asking as many sort of methodologies ask you to do the five whys. You know, you just keep going down like a kindergartner would ask their parent, why? And eventually he asks you to get it down to a single word. And that word, it's a small set of words that people typically choose from. And mine ended up being relationship. I love being in relationship with other people. Of meeting other people, getting to know them, getting to know their stories. And so that helped me understand why I would create a company like I did. You know, you think about Menlo, it's just fostered on building relationships with people. And then the question is why? Well, what is the purpose of those relationships? And, you know, I think I began to discover that the reason I got into this was because I wanted to delight others. I remember another story when I was a kid. My parents had bought a bookshelf. It was kind of a big deal purchase for them. It was going to go in the living room. It was going to be 8 feet wide and 6 feet tall. And it was out in the garage in a sort of cardboard box setup that you might get from IKEA today. My parents went out to dinner and a movie. And my 10-year-old self was home alone. And I had this notion that I would put that bookshelf together. So I went out in the garage and I put that whole thing together in a couple of hours, you know, 30 pieces of wood and 200 little nuts, bolts, and screws. And I was so excited. And then I realized, dang, I built it in the garage and mom and dad wanted it in the living room. And I inched that thing out the front of the garage, down the sidewalk, through the family room, the utility room, the kitchen, put it right in the living room where mom and dad wanted it. And I set up the stereo. I had it playing mom's favorite album. I put books and knickknacks on it. And when they walked in the door, my mom cried.
Oh my gosh.
And that to me is my personal definition of joy. When you work so hard for the delight of others. And I think as I started to remember those kind of stories through Michael Ray's work, I started to get a picture of who I was and what I wanted to do in the world and what would give me satisfaction. What would I be proud of? How would I leave the world a better place than I found it? And I think in those kind of stories and those kind of remembrances, your audience can find their own personal version of joy.
So now I have so many more questions, but let's go back. What kind of software do you build for your clients?
We are a custom software design and development firm. And what that means is we can work on just about anything. People come to us with ideas and we form teams around those ideas. We have a specialized group of people that do the front end work of this work. They are called high-tech anthropologists. That could probably be a whole other episode on this about high-tech anthropologist is and what they do. But the idea of high-tech anthropology, go out in the world and study the people who will one day use what you're creating so that, in fact, when you get done, it can be used without help text, user training, or dummies books. You know, and you think about my industry calls the people we serve stupid users, and then we write dummies books for those poor people. But it doesn't have to be that way. And then our software team builds the software that the high-tech anthropologists have designed. And so in this combination, we work in all kinds of industries. Some of our more famous projects, we rebuilt the organ transplant information system for the University of Michigan Health System. We built the world's leading software for the world's leading flow cytometer, which is a device used by cancer researchers, AIDS researchers, immunologists. I'm going to guess it's probably having some application in the work that's being done today around COVID-19. I don't know that to be true, but it wouldn't surprise me. So those kind of projects are hard, which makes it fun. Engineers like to work on hard problems. And they're satisfying because of the impact they have on lives.
I would imagine that as you're hiring people, you must have a pretty defined way of determining who'd be a good fit or not. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. We have a very different way of hiring. In concert with what I mentioned before, extreme programming, we created a process we call extreme interviewing. And that sounds scary, and it isn't. It's actually probably the opposite of scary. And the first time we did it, 20 years ago, April 1st of 2000, yep, April Fool's Day was the very first time we did this thing I'm about to describe. We've been using the same process ever since. We knew that in order to interview for this unusual workplace, right? This place where people are not working in offices and cubes, they're going to be pairing with other people in an open and collaborative environment. We probably needed to abandon the type of interviewing process I used to use, which I now sort of playfully describe as two people sitting across the table lying to each other for a couple of hours style of interview. So what we decided to do was trade it out for something that simulated the work environment. We're going to pair, let's pair during the interview. So we bring 30 or 40 or 50 people in at a time. We pair them with another candidate for 20 minutes and we have them work together while one of my team members watches them work. And we give the candidates the weirdest instructions ever. Meryl, if you were paired with Sergio, we would tell you, your job is to help Sergio get a second interview. And oh, by the way, Sergio, same thing for Meryl. Make your partner look good. Help them succeed. If they're struggling, help them out. There's no questions asked, and we aren't reviewing resumes. What we're looking at is at the person. How do they behave in this paired environment? 20 minutes of that pairing while you work on a task with a single pencil, a single piece of paper, and you're collaborating for 20 minutes while an observer watches and takes notes about what they see. Then we switch the pairs. And we do that three times. Again, simulating in an hour what work will feel like over weeks at Menlo. Different pair partners, different tasks, different approaches. Are you a good kindergartner? Do you play well with others? Do you not hit, bite, scratch, swear, run through the room with scissors over your head? And then after you all leave, if there were 30 of you, there would have been 15 of us watching, and we talk about what we saw. And quite frankly, the people who are watching are the people who one day will pair with you. So they're asking themselves a question based on what I saw. Would I like to pair with Meryl for 40 hours? And if that works, we invite you back for an 8-hour experiment inside of our Menlo software factory. You pair in with one Menlonian in the morning and another one in the afternoon. You put in 8 hours of work and we pay you. It's a one-day trial. And if that day works, we look for three votes there, you know, the two people you sat with and yours, because you might find out that this isn't for you and that's okay. And then we invite you in for a paid 3-week trial at that point, each week pairing with a different person, giving you feedback along the way. We don't expect a perfect Menlonian at the end of these 3 weeks, but we do expect to see progress towards the goal. And our goal is to be a good collaborator, to share, to think out loud, to help others solve problems, to bring your unique experiences to the table without offending others and with listening and being able to adapt to the people you're sitting with.
We've been referring to your culture. Let's talk about what the culture really is and how you really live it every day.
Yeah, when I talk about culture in talks I give around the world now, I use a metaphor of an airplane. And part of this is when I was young, I learned to fly little airplanes. I have a pilot's license. I haven't done that in a while, but in my youth, I did a lot of flying. And so if you think about the forces at work on an aircraft, most of us understand them pretty well, even if we don't have a pilot's license. There is the force of lift, the countervailing force of weight, the force of thrust that pulls us forward, and the countervailing force of drag that holds us back. I think this is a great metaphor for any culture, but if we want our corporate aircraft to get off the ground every day like an airplane, we have to increase the lift of human energy, and that's a big part of our culture. What is it that gives us human energy? Well, I think the physical space goes a lot to that. When people walk in the door of Menlo, we get about 3,000 visitors a year from all over the world who just come to see how we do what we do. They spend anywhere from a day to a week with us, just experiencing our culture, taking classes in it, interacting with our team, learning about how we work and why we do the way we do. And typically, when people walk in our door for the very first time, if I'm anywhere near the door, I can hear it on their voices as they walk in the front door. They say, "Wow," because they can feel the human energy in our room. I think a couple of big things drive human energy in any organization: clarity over ambiguity. What am I supposed to be working on? What's my highest priorities? What is the order in which I should be working on things? Too many of us live in a sea of ambiguity about that, which causes a lot of frustration and a lot of fear, quite frankly. And then the ability to go to work and get meaningful things done. like really done, not just, you know, get started and doing multitasking that none of us can actually do, but rather go to work, get something done, feel like it was meaningful, feel like it was part of some bigger plan that's going forward. So those things are things we focus on. We use visual management systems. We do paper-based planning and paper-based work authorization. It's up on walls. We chart our progress with yarn and push pins and sticky dots. So it's a very visual environment, which I think adds to the human energy. The weight that we're trying to avoid is the weight of bureaucracy, the weight of meeting load. We have very few meetings at Menlo, and the ones we do have, we keep very short because we're in one big open room. So if we can keep meeting load low, keep bureaucracy low, we'll never get rid of all of it. Keep the human energy high. Now we have a chance to get that plane off the ground. The thrust part is the thrust of purpose, making sure people understand those two questions. Who do we serve and what would delight look like for them? And that externally focused purpose. When I talk about purpose with people who come and visit us, I tell them, I'm going to take the three common stakeholders off the table when you think about purpose: customers, employees, and shareholders. Of course, you have to serve them, but that's still self-serving. I want you to think past all of them. Think of the life insurance company that might consider their policyholders to be the people they serve. Well, I would challenge them to say, no, I think it's the beneficiaries of the policy, the people who will one day call you in the moment of the darkest time of their life and expect a shoulder to cry on, not expect an offshore claims team who's been instructed to prevent fraud as their first line of defense against issuing a false claim. So if we understand what our purpose is, that can pull us forward. And the drag that holds us back is the big one, the drag of fear. There are so many ways we are taught to lead with fear in our careers. All the bosses we've worked for who cleverly could raise an eyebrow in a meeting or heave a sigh when somebody makes a point they don't agree with. And all those things, everybody scurries out afterwards. What did he mean by that? What was she implying when she raised her eyebrow? You know, all that kind of stuff. And we just need to eliminate that as much as we can. Those four forces that work on any organization are the ones we focus on in our culture. Keeping that lift high, making sure the purpose is strong, keeping the weight and the fear as much at bay as possible. We still have that, of course, but we can just minimize it. And then our organizational aircraft can get off the ground. And so we think a lot about those things. All of our practices are made to build that in. And I think underlying all of this is a culture of storytelling. That's why my title says Chief Storyteller.
Talk a little bit more about fear. You know, I know as a firm, we've always believed that you need to follow the fear, because if you can figure out what people are afraid of and change that, everything shifts. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that?
There's two kinds of fear, I think. There's a fear that we should be, things we should be afraid of. That's why we don't walk out into the street without looking both ways. It's why we're wearing masks right now and self-isolating at home during this pandemic. I mean, there are things we should be afraid of, and those are healthy fears. There's a reason fear is a built-in thing. But the kind of fear I think we need to, as leaders, we need to work hard to keep at bay. And what I'm about to describe is hard, particularly the way most of us were raised in our managerial lives and organizations. And that's the kind of fear we manufacture to artificially motivate people. That artificial fear in order to motivate. You know, I had a boss once who, when I started learning how to manage people, he brought me aside and he says, "Hey, Rich, if you see two people talking in a corridor to one another, just walk up to them and stand there. Don't say anything. They'll get back to work." Uh-huh. I mean, seriously. Or he would walk around. Tom Peters, who's one of my heroes, wrote Search of Excellence so many years ago.
Right.
He has this thing called management by walking around. I get what Tom means, but this boss took it to a new level. I call it management by walking around and annoying people.
Yeah, or staring them down.
You know, he'd come up and he'd walk into your cube when you were in the middle of something and say, "Hey, how's it going?" "Fine. What you working on?" "Well, the thing you gave me." "How's that going?" "Well, I'm a little bit beyond." "Oh, you coming in this weekend?" I'm like, "What are you doing here? Get out of here. You just like completely derailed me for the next hour because now I'm, you know, calling my wife and saying, hey, you know, I know we were going to do my kids, you know, our kid's birthday on Saturday, but it looks like I'm going to be working. So maybe we should put it off till Sunday." You know, that kind of stuff just isn't helpful. It isn't useful. It isn't productive. And how much damage did you do to that person up to that point? And there is one other aspect to this that I was just, I mean, it has been such a part of Menlo, and I've encouraged people to think this way. And it's this idea of running experiments in order to make change. I think too often we contemplate rather than take action. We are more willing to take a meeting than take action. We're going to form a committee to write a policy rather than to take action. And all of those things, I think, are evidence of a fear-based organization. But if you can shift to an action-oriented mentality, which says, we trust you. We know you're not going to go outside the bounds of what we're trying to do as an organization. We trust you to do the right thing. We trust you to make innovative approaches to what you're doing. And I delivered this kind of talk to a $30 billion, 180-year-old life insurance company called MassMutual. And 6 months later, they invited me back to show me what had happened after my encouragement. And Amy Ferreira, the VP of claims, took me back to the claims department. She said, Rich, when we go to claims, you're going to see helium balloons taped to people's desks. And I said, why the balloon? She said, well, we listened to what you said about running experiments. Everywhere there is a balloon taped to a desk is someone who is running an experiment. They're declaring it, and they're asking you with that balloon, they're inviting you to come ask them what their experiment is. I thought, oh, that's pretty darn cool, right? We turned the corner, looking out over this 100,000 square foot facility of claims processors. They process about $3 billion a year in claims at MassMutual every year. And there are balloons as far as I could see. I'm like, holy cow. So I run up to Susan's desk. I said, Susan, tell me about your experiment. She says, well, I'm in charge of quality. And that means I'm the last stop before the check gets cut to the beneficiary. And she said, I have a three-step process I have to go through. I have to do step A, step B, and step C. And I can tell already the way she's describing this, she's excited to tell me what she decided to do. She said, well, what I found out is if we find an error at step C, we have to go back and redo step B. And step B is the longest part of the process, and the order doesn't matter. So she said, my approach was, I'm going to just change our order. We're going to do A, and then C, and then B. Well, it didn't sound like a big deal to me, but she is just exuding pride over this experiment she's running. And I said, Susan, how long have you worked here? She said, 19 years. I said, have you always been like this? This energetic, you know, passionate person? And her face changes in an instant. She goes, no, I hated my job before. I hated coming to work. I dread the drive to the office. I was counting the days to retirement. I said, what's different now? She says, now we can run experiments. Now I love my job. I can't wait to get here. Imagine that. Imagine the change in just that one person. If we could get that kind of effect to ripple through our organization, we can fly to heights and distances that were previously unimaginable.
No, that's incredible. And I know you're working with a lot of companies, and you actually have part of your business is teaching people the Menlo way. And I'm just curious, as companies have worked with you, do you see a common denominator of what gets in the way when they're trying to really change and design the organization they want to become?
I think the biggest obstacle that people run into, and particularly the people who come and visit us, right? They go back to their offices, they're excited, they've learned something, they want to try it, and they run into somebody who hasn't seen what they've seen, maybe has been there longer than them. And as soon as they say, hey, I've got this great new idea, and that person says, oh, that won't work here. That's against our process. There's a policy against that. And the idea dies in the vine right then and there. And that's where I tell them, look them in the eye and say, I get it, but let's try it. Let's not form the policy to write the, to form the committee to write the policy. Let's take action.
So as people are looking for tangible tips, it sounds like that would be one of them, right? Run short experiments.
Yep.
What else would you suggest?
There is no question that top leaders can make big things happen. But the opportunity for each of us, no matter where we are in the organization, is still there. You can start from where you are. And I tell this story of Mike at McDonald's in the Detroit Metro Airport. Every time I'd go into Detroit Metro Airport, I'd succumb to a weakness of quarter pounder with cheese, large fry, and a Coke. And there was this guy there named Mike. He's working there. Older guy. And he was hustling from table to table, cleaning up the stuff, the sort of the impolite travelers left behind, the busy travelers. But every time he got near me, he leaned in and he looked me in the eye and he said, "Have a safe flight. Can I get you anything? Can I get you a napkin?" And I thought, wow, every time he was like this. And I've talked to others who knew this guy too, and they were like, he was amazing. And then one time I'm there, and he was off shift, and there's this kid pulling a sled full of garbage out of the back of the McDonald's going off to the dumpster, and he comes by my table, and this is a young kid, and he leans in, he goes, "How's it going? Have a safe flight. Can I get you anything? Can I get you a napkin?" And I thought, my gosh, what's going on at this McDonald's? This is one of the most relationless restaurants on the planet, inside of one of the most relationless places on the planet, an international airport. And they're doling out kindness every time. So I grabbed the manager and I thanked him. And he thanked me for noticing. But in this story, I'm pretty sure that manager didn't go to McDonald's corporate and say, "Hey, guys, can we form a committee to write a policy on delivering out kindness and napkins?" No, he just did it. And the point of this is, you can start from where you are. You don't have to change the world. You just have to change your world. Start with you.
Yeah.
Start with who you are. Change there and then change the people around you. And you can become that change you want to see in the world.
This is great advice. And you talk about starting from where you are, running experiments. What are some other things people could consider?
Yeah, well, I think the easiest place to pinpoint as a beginning is actually the hardest place to start. And it's where I had to start. I had this earth-shaking moment when I was a new VP. I took my 8-year-old in to work with me one day. And it was a take your daughter to work day program that the Ann Arbor Public Schools offered. And my kid watched her VP dad do VP work all day. Can you imagine a more boring day for a child to watch a VP work? Huh? And so she wisely brought her coloring books and stickers and crayons and worked silently at the task desk while I did my work all day. And at the end of the day, though, I thought I better ask her what she saw, because her teacher's going to ask her the next day. And I said, "Sarah, what'd you learn today?" She said, "What I learned, Dad, was you're really important here." I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, I saw that nobody here can make a decision without asking you first." Oh, my gosh. Right out of the mouths of babes. I mean, she was really proud, but I was mortified, because I realized in that moment, I had created an organization that couldn't move faster than me. I had to learn to trust the people who worked for me. And if I didn't trust them, I had to do the work of building trust with them. I had to become a different kind of leader. So as I point out earlier, the easiest place to pinpoint a beginning is the hardest place to start. You have to start with you. And that is difficult.
One of the things I'd love to ask you about is that, of course, the name of this podcast is Let Go and Lead. What do you believe leaders need to let go of most?
I think we need to let go of the idea that we are the smartest person in the room. And I think that's the way many of us got elevated. We drowned out the voices of others so we could be noticed as the smartest person in the room. And that's how we got elevated up. And I think the other most important point in all of this is leadership is not a position. It's not a position of hierarchical authority. You can lead from anywhere. You don't need a title change in order to become a leader. Leader is about influence, not about hierarchical authority. And the first person you need to lead is you. And you've got to practice leading yourself. You have to practice guarding your thoughts. How do you make sure that you're, you know, and this isn't about Pollyanna territory either. This isn't about ignoring reality. But when confronted with reality, we have a basic choice. I'm either going to let it defeat me, or I'm going to defeat that reality. And I can tell you, there's no better time, than right now for this kind of thinking. And you know, I'll readily admit, when all of this hit a few weeks ago, it knocked me off my chair. It personally took me a couple of weeks to start to reorient my thinking into what on earth has just happened here, and how are we going to maintain our culture, and how are we going to continue to pursue business and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, this isn't easy. And it isn't like it just automatically comes and everything goes just the way you want it to. But it is creating a resiliency that tells you, when something happens, and it will, and it will happen again, whatever the heck it is, it's not just our personal resiliency, it's our organizational resiliency. And that's what I'm getting to see right now. A lot of what buoyed my spirits up was how quickly my team adapted to all of this stuff. And I'm very proud of them. And they are themselves sending me notes about, it's going to be okay, Rich. We're going to be fine. We'll get through this. What a great thing to receive that back from my team, because I needed it.
It's definitely a trying time for all of us. And you just provided such great inspiration. And Rich, thank you so much for joining us. This was really a terrific conversation.
Thank you, Meryl. It was, as I said at the beginning, just a real delight to be with you. And I hope this brought some amount of joy to your listeners in this very difficult time we find ourselves in.
I'm so inspired by Rich and the Menlo Way. Here are a few of my many learnings. First, find your own definition of joy at work. The Menlo team derives joy from delighting those they serve. What does joy at work feel like for you? Second, remember the thrust that purpose can give your organization. As you reflect on Rich's life insurance example, think beyond your traditional stakeholders. Who do you really serve? What does delight look like for them? Third, recognize the power of igniting and sustaining human energy. For Rich, that comes not only from Menlo's physical environment, but also from providing his team with clarity over ambiguity and the ability to do meaningful work. Lastly, ask those you admire what they're reading. Dive into their recommendations. As you get inspired, reflect on why. Ask yourself, why did this paragraph speak to me? Rich and I have shared so many philosophies, and I thank him for the great conversation. Also, many thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, I'd love for you to share it with a friend or a colleague. With gratitude, this is Let Go and Lead.